Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 22nd, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the latest on how much water is on the moon, discovering the environmental causes of disease, and advances in immunotherapy to fight cancer. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how grammar can get politicians into trouble, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Last October, NASA smashed a rocket into the Cabeas crater near the moon's south pole, a crater that is permanently in shadow, very cold, and so likely to contain water. The impact threw tons of debris high enough into the lunar atmosphere to be illuminated by the sun, and so vaporizing any water ice, hydrocarbons, or organics into their basic components. In turn, that allowed scientists to use a variety of instruments to study the debris, to search for water and other materials that could be useful for further human exploration of our solar system. Last November, Tony Colaprete, principal investigator of this Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, or LCROSS, was holding a 2-gallon bucket at a NASA press briefing to talk about what they found.
Indeed, yes, we found water. And we didn't find just a little bit, we found a significant amount. Well, now I can say today that in the 20 to 30 meter crater LCROSS made, we found maybe about a dozen of these 2-gallon buckets worth of water. So this is initial results, it's preliminary, and it's probably a lower bound on the total amount of water we've seen here, and there's a whole lot more beyond the water. So that's the exciting part in my mind, is it's not only about the water now, there's actually a lot more here that we're going to be talking about in the months ahead, looking at the LCROSS data.
Now, in 6 papers in this week's Science, Colaprete and colleagues report their further analysis of the LCROSS data, estimating that the concentration of water ice in the lunar soil at the LCROSS impact site is about 5% by mass, and that there were a number of other volatile compounds. I spoke with Colaprete from his office at NASA's Ames Research Center in California.
The collection of papers show a combined view, a new view, I think, of the south pole of the moon, and in particular, the environment and materials inside the crater Cabeas. What we found was, I would say, an oasis in an otherwise desert on the moon that has highly concentrated water with respect to the moon, and a lot of other materials that were maybe in hindsight expected, but still quite a surprise in terms of the variety of compounds and the concentrations of those compounds. I think combined all together, looking at all the data sets, it really does paint a picture of the moon, of an active water cycle, of a place that is more complex than we probably ever appreciated, and it has, as I mentioned, these oases of water ice and other ices and volatiles that are very significant in terms of both from a scientific and an exploration standpoint.
Why is this an oasis?
The concentrations we saw in terms of total water ice concentrations is higher than can be explained with the neutron data if it was uniform like this everywhere. So we saw about 5.6% by weight water ice in the regolith where we impacted. If you took that 5.5% and made it uniform across all the cold areas, places cold enough to sustain ice or to retain ice, then you would get a very different measurement from the neutron spectrometer, the lunar exploration neutron detector on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LEND. That was the instrument that is measuring neutrons coming from the moon on the LRO spacecraft. If we were 5% or 5.5% in all the places that the Diviner instrument on LRO measured as cold enough to hold water, we wouldn't be able to explain the LEND measurements. They wouldn't be consistent with each other. So what makes them consistent is that water is, at these concentrations, 5%, is actually in pockets, in smaller, localized regions, rather than distributed uniformly. And that concept, I think, is really accentuated or demonstrated in the fact that if you look at the temperatures of the crater, some of them are very cold as Cabeas, where we impacted, maybe 40 or 50 Kelvin. And yet they don't show signs of enhanced hydrogen at scales or in quantities similar to what we see in Cabeas or in some other places. So what that tells us is that temperature alone is not enough. Just being cold doesn't mean you're going to have water ice on the moon, that there's something else, some other either the delivery process or some other factors in terms of retention that are making the distribution of these pockets of ice much, much less uniform than one might otherwise expect. So Cabeas, which is one of the, if not the highest hydrogen concentration in the South Pole, is one of these places, one of these oases where we found quite a bit of water ice, 5% by weight. We found a lot of other materials, molecular hydrogen, ammonia, methane, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, a laundry list, if you will, of various compounds frozen out there. We don't know if these things exist elsewhere, but we certainly do know that the hydrogen is highest in only certain locales on the moon, certain oases on the moon.
Do you feel that you have enough information at this point to describe the active water cycle that you mentioned?
Oh, I don't know that we have enough information to really describe it, but, well, we have certainly more than what we had before, and we have enough to know that our models, our previous models, need some updating. With the observations from the Moon Mineralogical Mapper on the Chandrayaan spacecraft, the Indian spacecraft, and Cassini and the Epoxy spacecraft, those instruments measured the water and hydroxyl OH in sunlight regions. When you take those measurements and you fold them into the observations from LCROSS and LRO, we're looking at a much more complex and dynamic water cycle than I think we ever really appreciated. When you look at some of the materials we see and the relative abundances to water that we see in the LCROSS data set, then you start to formulate a picture of one that has a variety of sources, not just the solar wind, but also probably asteroids or comets bringing material in the last couple billion years, that material migrating around the moon, being acted on in the moon. There appears to be what we call cold grain chemistry occurring within the dark cold traps. So it is a very complicated environment and really has opened up a whole new area of research that I think is going to be ushered in with these new results. Future missions are going to help. The LADEE spacecraft, the Lunar Atmospheric Dust Environment Explorer, is an orbiter that's slated to launch in 2013 by NASA. And it's going to look for the atmosphere. It's going to study the atmosphere of the moon and dust migration on the moon in the atmosphere. And so it's going to, again, contribute some data and some measurements and observations that we don't have yet that will, again, add to our total understanding of this water cycle. There are plans in the next year, I know of, to get the community together to really start looking at these data sets and start piecing together a new model, a new understanding for the moon's water cycle and what we see at the moon today.
Now, as I understand it, this mission was designed with the idea of seeing, is there enough water to be useful for supporting future manned missions to the moon in terms of oxygen to breathe, hydrogen to use as fuel? With this amount of water spread in these various locales, is there enough?
There is, yes, yes. The amount of water, let me start basically from the requirements LCROSS was given. LCROSS was an exploration mission. It had a basic set of measurements that were to be strategic inputs to the path forward for NASA in terms of exploration. One of those basic measurements was to determine the form of the hydrogen. What was it? Was it water? Was it just hydrated minerals? Was it just solar protons stuck in the dirt? The other strategic measurement was, if it is water, is the concentration greater than 1%? If it is, that means that it would be cost-effective to extract, so that the return would be greater than the expense of going into a cold trap and extracting it, compared to just extracting hydrogen or oxygen from dry lunar soil somewhere at lower latitudes. And so our measurements had to detect down to at least a 0.5% water. And that was basically the control over whether or not this was a useful resource or just an interesting resource. And we saw 5%, so 5 times more than what has been deemed by some literature as being the return cutoff, so the return point, positive return point. So based on that, yes, given 5% water by weight, this is a very effective resource and would provide the benefits, if you could extract it and could get at it and utilize it, would be more beneficial than if you try to do the same things with dry lunar regolith anywhere else on the moon.
That was Tony Colaprete, principal investigator of the LCROSS mission and lead author of a paper on the detection of water on the moon. Find all 6 papers in this week's Science about the mission and experiment, as well as Richard Kerr's News of the Week story on the subject, titled, How Wet is the Moon? Just Damp Enough to Be Interesting. Also in this week's Science, on the origins of neural diseases. Microglia cells are associated with many neurodegenerative diseases, but the origin of these cells isn't well known. In a paper published online by Science, Florent Genoux and colleagues report that microglia cells derive very early in embryo development from specialized white blood cells called primitive macrophages. Using live mice, the team used a technique called lineage tracing to label cells and trace the cell's progeny through development. Researchers already knew that microglia are maintained throughout life independently of any blood input, and that primitive macrophages are conserved across many species and appear to play an important role in the early embryo, differentiating in the yolk sac of mammals, birds, and zebrafish prior even to the beginning of blood circulation. Now, by understanding that microglia derive from these primitive macrophages, the researchers say that the knowledge should help identify new means to manipulate microglia for the treatment of neural diseases. Read the paper, Fate Mapping Analysis Reveals That Adult Microglia Derive from Primitive Macrophages, online at scienceexpress.org. The Human Genome Project has yielded an enormous amount of data, but it hasn't explained much about disease. Researchers have learned that very few diseases are explained by a single gene, and so have developed genome-wide association studies, or GWAS, that allow scientists to identify genetic associations with a particular disease. Stephen Rappaport researches exposure biology at the University of California, Berkeley.
So with GWAS, you're not saying that I'm going to look at this handful of genes because we've hypothesized for various reasons that they're going to be important. I'm going to look at all the genes and let the data tell me which ones are really important.
Still, Rappaport says, by some estimates, 70 to 90% of disease risks are probably due to differences in environment, not genetic factors. Rappaport is co-author of a perspective in this week's Science on disease risk from the environment.
So we would like to develop a similar approach for looking at environmental exposures, and environmental is writ very large here, meaning things that are not caused by genes. So these would be the effects to human health that come from other factors besides the genes.
The obvious exposures include radiation, infections, drugs, pollution, exposures that can even alter the genome. But Rappaport's definition of environment literally includes everything not in the genome. Things, Rappaport says, that people don't think of or can't remember when they are surveyed about what they've been exposed to, including food, hormones, even lifestyle.
So we're interested in a much more global view of exposure, saying that the human body is bombarded with chemicals from both outside the body and from within the body, and we really want to get a handle on what they are, do these GWAS-type studies where we look at cases and controls and see if we can find some particular exposures that are associated with the effects or the diseases.
The reason this hasn't really been done before, says Paolo Venus, an environmental epidemiologist at Imperial College London, is because the technology to do so is still fairly new.
Now we have new technologies which are called omics collectively, which allow us to look into chemicals in the body and characterize a little better what we are exposed to in terms of hazardous substances.
But Venus says these omics, such as metabolomics, transcriptomics, and proteomics, had methodological problems and so weren't very accurate in the recent past.
So now we have the technology, but we need to set up studies, very accurate studies on human populations exposed to different agents. So we need to create consensus.
Consensus, Vines says, that's needed to support the technologies and collaborations to study the effects of the environment on disease risk and not just continue studying genetics.
In the last 10 years, there was a very strong emphasis on genetics. And that was extremely fruitful because we know now much more than we knew 10 years ago. Really, it's incomparable what we know now to 10 years ago. But now we have to move towards the technologies which refer to the environment.
We don't really know what the main risk factors are coming from these environmental exposures.
Again, prospective author Stephen Rappaport.
We want to adopt more discovery-driven methods to at least tell us what the main players are. And once we know what the main players are, that is, which chemical factors in our internal environments are causing disease, then we can start to ask questions about where these chemicals come from, how do they actually cause the disease, what can we do to mitigate the exposures, what can we do to reduce the exposures or otherwise treat the conditions as they develop rather than after the point where they've caused diseases.
But both Rappaport and Venus say that this kind of conceptual makeover will be difficult for people to subscribe to. In part, that's because it is different than many people's conception of what science itself is. There's no hypothesis testing here. In addition, this kind of research doesn't focus on a particular disease, like cancer, heart disease, or diabetes, diseases that researchers can get funding to study. In many ways, Rappaport says, the proposed project to study disease risk from environmental factors is a lot like the Human Genome Project, which sequenced the human genome, identified all human genes, and made all the information widely available for further biological study.
Well, right now we have great genetic factors that we can look at, but we're still relying on whether people tell us what they do in order to get the environmental factors. But it just turns out that genetic factors aren't the prime players in predicting chronic diseases. That's the problem. So clearly, the weak link in the system now is the information about exposure, and it's not going to be easy or even possible in most cases to find these joint effects of genes and environment. So we need a much more comprehensive view of the chemical environment inside the body.
You can read Rappaport's perspective, co-authored by Martin Smith, entitled Environment and Disease Risks, in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, mosquito speciation. The mosquito species Anopheles gambiae, a major vector of malaria, is currently undergoing speciation into two forms. That poses challenges for malaria epidemiology and control because speciation may mean different behaviors and physiologies affecting malaria transmission. Now, Mara Lonizak and colleagues report in a paper in this week's Science that based on the complete genome sequences of both species, there's already widespread genetic divergence between the two species, even though morphologically the two species are indistinguishable at all stages of life. That suggests greater challenges to researchers trying to identify the genetic origins of this speciation, a more advanced speciation process than previously thought. In a related study, Daniel Nifsi, Mara Lonizak, and colleagues use single nucleotide polymorphism genotyping to map the genetic diversity and detect what are called selective sweeps that suggest that these two populations of this malaria vector mosquito are experiencing different selective pressures that are independently shaping their genetic variation. And that, the researchers say, implies that tools for genome-wide monitoring of population structure of malaria vector mosquitoes will be useful for eradicating the disease. Find both papers on what the genomes of these mosquitoes reveal in this week's Science.
Well, this is a story about immune therapy for cancer, which means trying to stimulate the immune system to attack and destroy tumor cells.
Science's Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports in this week's issue that after years of trying, cancer researchers say they are finally having success at treating cancer with immunotherapy.
And this is something that isn't really new in the cancer field. People have been trying it for many, many, many years, and they just have not had much luck in getting it to work. I wrote the story when I did because there is a fair amount of new work coming out with other new therapies or therapies that have been tinkered with that now actually seem to be working fairly well, and people in the field are pretty excited about it.
What makes cancer susceptible to treatment by the patient's own immune system?
Well, this is something that's been controversial for a long time, but people had suspected that the immune system would naturally recognize cancer as being foreign and attack it, just like it would attack a bacteria or a virus in your body. And the reason for that, we think, is because tumor cells develop genetic mutations that are specific to them, and the immune system then recognizes those as foreign and, in theory at least, can go after the tumor cells.
Is there something that prompted doctors and researchers to consider helping the immune system treat cancer?
Well, there were several different people who began working on this a number of years ago for different reasons. One person that I focused on in my story is Steven Rosenberg, who's the chief of surgery at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. He got interested in it when he was quite young. He was a resident in Boston, and he met a patient named James D'Angelo, who was then in his 60s, and Mr. D'Angelo had been admitted to the hospital for gallbladder surgery. But as it happened, he'd actually more than 10 years earlier had had a stomach cancer that had spread in his body, and at the time was told that there really wasn't anything that could be done for him. He was sent home to die. And unbelievably, his cancer just disappeared somehow on its own. It wasn't really clear why. So 12 years later, Mr. D'Angelo shows up, meets Dr. Rosenberg for the gallbladder surgery, and Dr. Rosenberg is really quite taken aback by this story and starts thinking about, you know, what happened in Mr. D'Angelo's body that made this possible, and starts wondering whether somehow the immune system attacked and destroyed Mr. D'Angelo's cancer and kept it away.
Are there particular cancers that spontaneously go away on their own more often than others?
Well, it's very rare for really any cancer to do this, but one type of cancer that people have been interested in for a while is melanoma, which is an aggressive skin cancer, and there have been some rare cases in which melanoma tumors, primary melanoma tumors, so the first tumors that show up, do disappear. It's rare, but it has happened, and that's one reason why doctors have been interested in using immunotherapy to try and treat melanoma.
And what are these new advances in immunotherapy?
Well, there are a couple different categories. So one is antibody therapy, and antibodies are used to treat other diseases like autoimmune diseases, and they've been used a little bit in cancer. But these antibodies, and there are a couple that are in clinical trials and that have been looking pretty promising, basically try to ramp up T cells to go after tumors. And they're being used in all sorts of cancers. So even though people initially looked at melanoma and maybe a couple other kinds of cancers, they now think that really this approach is pretty general and can work in all different tumors. So that's one category, the antibodies. And the other is an approach that Dr. Rosenberg pioneered, but a number of others are working in it as well, which is a T cell therapy. And in that case, T cells are taken out of tumors, usually out of tumors, and they're expanded, so they're grown into many billions of cells, and then they're given back to the patient. And in some studies that have been done, those actually work quite well at eliminating cancer altogether, even in people who have really severe cases of cancer, particularly melanoma.
So these are the T cells that are already at work trying to fight the cancer off.
That's right. These are T cells in the tumor. There's also some effort to take T cells out of the bloodstream and genetically modify them so that they can go after the tumor as well. That work is pretty early, but people are looking at that as well.
And how often does it work, immunotherapy?
Well, it depends what treatment you're talking about, and these different therapies are at all different stages. So,
how about melanoma?
So it's still a small, relatively small percentage of people who are doing well. In most trials, it's about 15%, depending on how you count it. In some studies, we do see some higher numbers, but a lot of those haven't been tested in many, many people, which is often what people think is needed to really understand the success rate. So certainly not everybody is responding right now to these treatments.
And what are the upsides of using immunotherapy to treat cancer over conventional therapies?
Well, I mean, I would say the upside is just that it seems to work more than, at least it works in people who have not responded to other therapies. Beyond that, there isn't really anything you can, because these treatments are so different from each other, even if they're all immunotherapies, you can't really generalize. Like the Rosenberg stuff is pretty toxic, whereas some of the antibodies are really, you know, one antibody is pretty toxic, one antibody is not so toxic.
So it's not as if it's particularly better than chemotherapy or radiation or other things?
Yeah, I would say in general in cancer, once the cancer has spread or metastasized to other parts of the body, it's very, very hard to get rid of it or even to get it to a point where it stays stable for a very long time. And what people have been finding with immune therapy, and again, some of these are small trials. The drugs haven't been tested in all that many people, so we don't have as much information as we'd like to have right now. But there are definitely patients now who have been treated in these trials who have a lot of tumors all over their bodies, and the therapies have either totally eliminated the cancer and kept it away for several years, or they've shrunk the tumors and gotten the person to the point where they have a what we think of as stable disease, so the tumors are just kind of sitting there, not really doing very much, whether or not the person is still receiving treatment.
Well, have any of these therapies made it all the way to market, or are they still in the researchers' clinics?
There's one cancer vaccine for prostate cancer that was approved earlier this year. It's for people with prostate cancer that has spread, metastatic prostate cancer. And that's a vaccine that's sort of made to order, so it's made for each individual patient. And men who are receiving it will get 3 infusions of the vaccine, and then they're done. And that vaccine extends life by about 4 months or so. So it's not a huge difference, but a lot of people in the field are hopeful that this at least suggests that companies are interested in this area because these treatments are quite different to manufacture, to produce, and a company did go forward with this even though it wasn't immune therapy. And many more companies are now interested in these antibodies and in other vaccines, and they've gotten quite interested in this area. Another thing to mention is that this prostate cancer vaccine, which is made by a company called Dendrion in Seattle, is quite expensive. It costs $93,000 right now to get these 3 infusions. And that's to extend life by an average of 4 months. So it's a pretty costly treatment.
So what will it take for immunotherapy to become standard care?
Well, that's a good question. And it depends in part on which immunotherapy we're talking about. So the antibodies that are in clinical trials right now are relatively easy to administer. They're given in an outpatient clinic. One challenge is that the way people respond to different immune therapies is quite different than the way they respond to chemotherapy or targeted treatments. It can take a lot longer for the cancer to respond to an immune treatment. We don't really understand why, but that's something that clinicians are going to have to kind of figure out and adjust to as they incorporate these therapies into the clinic, assuming that they do get approved. And I guess when we're talking about Dr. Rosenberg's approach of cell therapy, the surgeon at the National Cancer Institute, that's pretty challenging because right now it really requires a research clinic to grow these cells. It's also quite expensive as a therapy, and it may be a little more difficult or a lot more difficult, some people think, to move that to patients because right now it's only done in a few centers. It's really tough to start up these programs. But Dr. Rosenberg, when I talk to him, you know, acknowledges that people are skeptical in particular about his cell therapy because it's so tough to set up the programs that make that therapy usable. But he really thinks that, you know, once we find things that work and that are treating these very dire cases of cancer, industry and scientists and everyone will find ways to make them happen and to get them to the people who need them.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports in this week's issue that after years of trying, cancer researchers say they are finally having success at treating cancer with immunotherapy. Finally, today, David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how grammar can get politicians into trouble. How so, Dave?
Well, Rob, this study will be familiar to you if you remember anything from high school English. It has to do with some fairly obscure grammatical rules known as the perfect and the imperfect aspect. So for example, Rob, last week you and I taped the podcast. That taped is known as the perfect aspect because grammarians would say the event was bounded in time. That is that it happened. We taped. Done. End of story. Whereas the imperfect aspect would be something like, last week you and I were taping the podcast. Now this time the event is still in the past, but this whole "we're taping" it's not so much bounded in time anymore. It almost gives the sense that it's still happening.
Dave, isn't it still happening?
It is still happening, but the last week's taping isn't still happening. Now, you may want to ask, what does all this have to do with politics? Well, it turns out a lot of phrases that are used to describe politicians or their actions can have perfect or imperfect aspects in them. And in this study, a team of researchers, to test whether describing a politician with a perfect or imperfect aspect would influence feelings about that politician, specifically feelings about whether that politician was re-electable or not, researchers took 188 students and they showed them some phrases about a hypothetical politician named Mark Johnson. And one of these phrases was, last year, Mark was having an affair with his assistant and was taking hush money from a prominent constituent.
That was the imperfect aspect, meaning that he still could be.
Exactly. And other students looked at this sentence. Last year, Mark had an affair with his assistant and took hush money from a prominent constituent.
The perfect aspect. It does sound like it's over and done with.
Exactly. And it turns out that those real subtle changes in the sentence had a very dramatic impact on the readers. More than three quarters of the students who read the imperfect aspect, the was having an affair and was taking hush money, said they were confident that Johnson would not be reelected, whereas only about half who read the perfect aspect felt the same way. And it wasn't just their feelings about whether this hypothetical politician would be reelected. It was also these subtle changes in grammar also affected how much money the students thought he took. The readers that read the imperfect aspect was taking hush money. More than half of them assumed that Johnson had taken more than $100,000, whereas those that read took hush money, the perfect aspect, only about a third of them thought he took an amount that large. So even though these sentences seem very, very similar, there's a lot of subliminal stuff going on in them that can really influence perception about these people.
So is this more a lesson for politicians and political scientists or for the reporters who write about them?
Well, you know, this study didn't really test what the politicians were saying themselves. It was more about what was said about the politicians. So it's really more of a lesson for reporters who write about these people, but also potentially for people who craft attack ads, because you can imagine if you just change the language very subtly, and if you're trying to imply that your opponent is corrupt or having an affair or whatever, just some subtle word changes can make a big difference. But, you know, one expert says that this information could be important to voters as well, because the more informed we are about these manipulations that can be made, the better consumers we are, as it were, of political information, and the better we could tease out exactly what's going on.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the effect of grammar on politicians to the effect of a father's diet on his children, this next story is about how fat dads can pass down ill effects to their children even before birth.
Through their sperm?
That's the only way to do it. You know, studies have shown, Rob, that if a mother drinks or smokes or does a lot of other bad things during pregnancy, it can really affect the fetus, not only the development of the fetus, but can have harmful effects for the child as it grows throughout life. But in terms of the father's impact on a baby, it sort of ends with the sperm, because the father is not nurturing the child in the womb, obviously. And a lot of these problems with children, you know, can be attributed to environmental factors or genetic factors. This study's about a little bit of both. It's not purely genetic. It's not purely environmental. It's something called epigenetics.
So we're not talking about the environment that the father helps create by smoking around the mother or, after the child is born, having lots of junk food around.
No, this is actually something the father passes down that's not just DNA. When people talk about epigenetics, they talk about these tiny chemical modifications to DNA. They kind of act like volume knobs. So they can, even though you have a gene, these epigenetic modifications can turn the activity of the gene way up or way down or even on or off.
So I imagine this research was not done in people.
It wasn't done in people. It was done in rats. And what the researchers did was they had this suspicion that if a father is obese, a human father is obese, then he can pass down problems linked to obesity like diabetes to his children, even if that's not something that's encoded in his DNA. Again, they're thinking about these epigenetic changes. Maybe a father who eats a lot of hamburgers or a lot more hamburgers than he should has these epigenetic changes happen to the DNA in his sperm. And this sperm, when it it comes incorporated into the child will also have these potentially harmful epigenetic changes. But you're right, really hard to test in people. So what the researchers did in this study was they turned to rats and they fed male rats the equivalent of a junk food diet. They fed them this food that had 40% more fat than their normal food. And as expected, the rats got pretty fat. You can actually see a picture of a fat rat if you want to on the site. And what they did was they mated these fat males to normal weight females. And then they looked at all the offspring. And what they found is, especially among the female offspring, these daughters, these rat daughters, showed a lot of signs that researchers associate with early diabetes. By the time they reached puberty, their insulin levels didn't rise in response to high glucose, like you see in diabetics. And they had other problems that the researchers associate with diabetes. They saw some issues in sons as well, but it was mostly in the daughters. Also, the daughters were underweight at birth, and in humans, being underweight at birth has been linked to a lot of other problems later in life, specifically obesity. So they show in the study that even though it's just in rats, merely having an obese father, and this is not a father who was obese because of his genes, this was a father that was obese because he ate this really high-fat diet, was able to pass these negative consequences of obesity down to his offspring.
So we have to stop thinking of all this as genetic.
Exactly. And researchers actually say, you know, it's not just obesity. There's other issues that people think might have epigenetic mechanisms, things like smoking and even exposure to pesticides. We think of these things as only affecting us because we're the ones that are blackening our lungs or potentially giving ourselves cancer by getting exposed to too many pesticides. But the researchers say that it's possible that just like obesity, these toxins could be creating epigenetic changes in our DNA that we can pass down to our children.
The epigenetic relationship with women already pretty clear then.
Well, Rob, in this study, the researchers are really focusing on the males because we already know so much about how a mother can influence her fetus, you know, and it's really hard to separate out the genetic factors from the epigenetic factors, from the dietary factors. At least with fathers, you have this really clear stopping point. His contribution ends at the sperm, and the fetus, from a genetic and epigenetic point of view, is on its own from that point on, at least as far as the father's contribution is concerned.
Okay, so last one. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of conception, this last story is about the conception of what may have been one of the first galaxies in the universe. In fact, this is the oldest and farthest away object astronomers have ever seen. This galaxy is 13.1 billion light years away, which also means it's 13.1 billion years old.
Why hadn't researchers noticed this one before?
Well, Rob, as you can imagine, anything that's that far away is incredibly faint when astronomers do these sky surveys. And this discovery actually came from something called the Wide Field Camera 3 on the Hubble Space Telescope. And what researchers detected was this really faint blip. And they actually detected this a little while ago, but it took them a really long time to measure how far this object was away. And they find that out by looking at something called the redshift. And this is basically looking at the spectrum of light emitted by this galaxy. And from that, they can tell how far away it is. And that's how they got it, the 13.1 billion light year away figure.
Is this observation revealing anything new about our understanding of the origin of the universe?
Well, it's actually confirming something that astronomers had long suspected. Even a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, when the universe started, there was basically just all these protons and electrons that were starting to get together and form hydrogen. And about 150 million years after this, the first stars and galaxies began to form, but we can't see those really early stars and galaxies because all this hydrogen that was forming at the time creates this sort of fog in the universe, which prevents us from seeing these really, really early stars and galaxies. But the age of this galaxy suggests it formed about 600 million years after the Big Bang. And that's a period where this fog had started to lift, where there was enough star formation that the stars themselves were actually emitting radiation that was basically splitting this fog up. And so what astronomers can confirm now is that the fog had already lifted by about 600 million years ago. Now, they think if they go back too much farther before that, even though there may be galaxies and stars that formed that early, they're not going to see them because of this fog. So this may be one of the first galaxies to emerge from this cosmic haze.
Suggesting that there may be other galaxies that are around that old.
There could be. And in fact, the astronomers saw other faint objects in these pictures taken by Hubble, but they haven't analyzed all of them yet.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, speaking of astronomy, we've got a story about a very unusual black hole and also a story about scientists who are dancing their PhDs. A few months ago, Science launched its third competition for grad students, postdocs, and professors to act out their PhD theses in dance form. And earlier this week, judges in New York crowned a winner from 45 entries. So you can see all of those videos plus the winner on the site. And on Science Insider, we've got a story about the UK budget. There's some very drastic cuts being implemented, and we'll tell you what the impact will be on science. And also an update on a controversial science prize named after a corrupt dictator. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the October 22nd, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.